Welcome back to East Meets West. I'm Olga.
I'm Tara. Thank you so much for joining us.
And you know, we're here trying to keep you in the loop of major events in the world. So last time when we did our previous recording of our podcast, of our previous episode, and then right after that, a terrible thing happened to RT correspondent Steve Sweeney, who is reporting from Lebanon. And he was almost directly hit by an American missile launched by the Israelis. The missile actually hit the bridge 3 meters, literally, behind him. Steve was injured. Luckily, he's back in the field.
Yeah. And he and his cameraman bravely, you know, took that on and were even recording in the hospital. So we're lucky enough to have Steve with us all the way from Lebanon right now.
Great. Steve, are you with us?
Hi. Yeah. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I'm with you.
happy with to us. See you alive and kicking.
Yes.
So, and we know you're back in the field.
I still see some bandages. Yeah. How are your arms? You were injured by shrapnel, I take it.
Yeah. So, I mean, just obviously most people would have seen the footage of the airstrike on us that took place. It was just over a week ago. And we were reporting on the attack on bridges across the south of Lebanon. This is the bridges that kind of cross the Litani River. This is the area some 20 kilometers from the border. And this is the area that the Israelis want to take full control of. Some, including Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, says they want to make that the new border of Israel. So they want to. They don't want to just occupy it briefly or create this buffer zone, but the aim is really for them to take that land, which is something that they've coveted for a very, very long time. Actually, even before the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, they've wanted that land. They see it as their biblical right. So the day before, so the incident happened on a Thursday, the day before the Israeli Defense Force had issued a statement saying that it was going to attack all of the bridges crossing that area south of the Litani River. Now, you can imagine there's an awful lot of bridges. So the bridge that we reported from was the Kazmir Bridge, which is not the main Kazmir Bridge. There are two bridges. One of them is a fairly small bridge, actually. It's just a small crossing over a very shallow, thin part of the Litani River. And it's really used by Lebanese civilians just to cross into each other's villages. And, you know, it's a very, very small bridge. You can cross it by foot quite easily. So we went there because, obviously, this was a hugely important news story because the cutting off of these bridges, of the destruction of these bridges, essentially cuts off the whole of the south of Lebanon from the rest of the country. We'd already seen the forced displacement order put in place, the evacuation order, which meant that people south of the Litani River have been forced from their homes. They've been pushed out into places like Beirut, where I am now, other cities in the north. And as you can imagine, the sheer scale of the evacuations, we're talking over 1 million people. That's around a quarter with now of the Lebanese population have been effectively expelled from their land. Some are describing this as an ethnic cleansing operation on a scale far larger than the Nakba. This is the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land on the formation of the State of Israel. And I don't think it's off the mark to describe it in those terms, certainly from what we're seeing. So people are now sleeping where they can, essentially, because the services, the Lebanese government, they open like municipal buildings, schools, the hotels open their doors to take in displaced people. But of course, they're full. You know, there's only so much capacity that these buildings can take. So people are sleeping on the streets, they're sleeping in their cars, they're even on the beach. And we saw that horrific attack where 8 people were killed in an airstrike on the beach at the Corniche here in Beirut, a very popular tourist area, days after they struck the Ramada Hotel. So that was the context. We came to report on this because it's a huge news story. Now, we're experienced war correspondents, myself and my dear friend and colleague, Ali Rida Speiti, and he's from South Lebanon, so we know the land very well. We've been reporting from the ground for more than 2 years now, particularly in that that part of the country. And so we're very conscious about safety. We don't take any unnecessary risks in our reporting. Obviously, it comes with a risk, but we're very, very careful. When we approached the bridge, it had already been destroyed, right? So mm-hmm. you imagine there's nothing really there. There was like a slight part of the bridge that was still intact, enough maybe for one or two people to walk across, but certainly no vehicle could cross it. There was, there was no military objective in targeting the bridge, which is something that Maria Zaharova pointed out in her statement afterwards. So as we were there, we spoke to the Lebanese army. So the Lebanese army has a barracks on the bridge or just in front of the bridge. Mm-hmm. We pulled up, we spoke to them and said, is it okay to film here? And they said, yes, of course, it's fine. It's perfectly safe for you to film here, but you can't take your vehicle. So park up, walk onto the bridge, film, and you're fine. Now, they would know if it's mm-hmm. safe or not, because had that bridge been due to be targeted again, what happens is the Israelis will get a message to the Lebanese army. They don't have direct contact, but by UNIFIL, the United mm-hmm. Nations Peacekeeping Force. That's how they communicate with each other. So they would have told UNIFIL that this bridge is about to be targeted, so pull back, stay away, don't go on the bridge, and then once it's safe, we'll give you the all clear. So that this kind of blows a hole in the lie that the Israelis said that they had given prior warning that this bridge was going to be attacked. Now, to say that they didn't know we were on the bridge is simply inconceivable. This is Israel. Israel has the most advanced military technology in the world, but it also has the most advanced surveillance technology in the world. So, in other words, it knows everything that happens in the south of Lebanon. It knows every vehicle. It knows their registration numbers. It listens to our messages. It listens to our conversations. So it knows every single movement, really, inside the south of Lebanon. They know us because, we've been reporting there for 2 years. So they know the vehicle. They know, and it's clearly marked with press. And if you saw, we had our clearly marked press jackets on.
You did.
So it's, they knew that we were there. There was no military objective in targeting the bridge again. So this is why we called it a deliberately targeted strike aimed at killing us.
And I wanted to ask you a quick question about that. This deliberate strike against you, against journalists, is something that Israel has been doing for a while. They've targeted journalists and civilians. Mm-hmm. But they're using American weapons. Is that true? The weapon that hit you was American. Is that right?
Excalibur, right?
Well, yes, we can say now we've spoken to a lot of military experts and weapons experts, and people have analysed what it was that actually struck the bridge that day. What we know so far, and again, there have been calls for investigations into that to determine exactly what it was. But we're working on the premise that it was an F-16 fighter jet and mm-hmm. it was a GBU-38 guided missile. This is like a 500-pound missile. 200 pounds of it is a warhead. So you imagine if you look at the footage, when it comes in, because the fighter jets have been flying overhead most of the time we were on the bridge, but they were flying away from us towards Tyre, the coastal city of Tyre. So they were flying away from there. They were bombing what they would say are Hezbollah positions around that area where the battle is most intense. So we weren't really unduly concerned about that, because this is very common in the skies over South Lebanon now. You hear the fighter jets almost constantly. But what then all of a sudden we did hear was this fighter jet heading towards us at very, very low altitude. Mm. And then I'm assuming we must have heard, it's all a bit of a blur really, because it's very disorientating what happened. I can just remember hearing this huge explosion and thinking, we're dead. But when you look at the footage and it's been slowed down, we think it's this GBU-38. And if you see where it goes, you can see the bridge. There's a huge hole in the bridge because it had already been targeted. The missile went in that hole. Had it been a foot the other way, then according to people that we've spoken to, one would have certainly been killed, but two, there would have been no bodies even recovered because of the power of this missile. So the Israelis knew exactly what they were doing. So that's why we say it was deliberately targeted. That's why we say that they tried to kill us, because, I mean, even though it went into that hole, it's only by sheer luck, really, that we survived, because the amount of shrapnel that came out. So I got an injury. You can see here, we've just mm-hmm. taken the bandages off for the first time yesterday, but the shrapnel went in through here.
Oh, wow.
It went right away through the muscle. Yeah, it went through the muscle in this arm, and it was lodged in here. So the wonderful medical team at the Jabal Amour Hospital in Tyre, I mean, they were fantastic. And I just want to say about these people, because the Lebanese army, in the immediate aftermath, they put tourniquets on us to stop the blood flowing from my arms. But they called an ambulance. I thought, I'm okay, it's just a little scratch. we'll just get in the car and we'll drive off. But they called an ambulance, and ambulances are now targets for the Israelis. More than 40 paramedics and emergency workers have been killed since March the 2nd. The IDF issued a statement maybe a week before. This was after 12 people were killed in a massacre in an attack on a base for paramedics and emergency workers, 12 people. And they said, without any evidence, that the ambulances and medical facilities were being used by Hezbollah for military purposes. I can categorically say that's a lie. I've been not only in the back of ambulances, we went to the Jabal Amour Hospital, which itself had been partly destroyed, badly damaged.
It was Israeli damaged strike. As well, the hospital.
Yeah, they've damaged and destroyed the hospitals. And we've been to many of the stations where the civil defence workers are based. We know some of them personally as well. I mean, we've been working in the field a long time, so we know a lot of these people. And they're risking their lives to go to the site of the Israeli attacks on civilian areas. And they're coming under fire themselves. Just a few days ago, two people, there was a very tragic tale, two emergency workers, volunteers, in fact, were killed on their motorcycle as it was targeted by the Israelis. One of them just, I think, 15 or 16 years old. A French crew were on the scene making a film about the emergency workers, and they filmed it, and there was just a very harrowing scene where the commander of this medical team, as he went on the scene, he found it was his son that was killed.
Horrific.
I mean, heartbreaking. Absolutely horrific and heartbreaking.
Is Israel going to be held accountable for these are war crimes? You're describing war crimes, going targeting journalists like yourself, targeting emergency workers in hospital and civilians in this manner. These are war crimes. So what are you hearing on the ground as far as that goes from other countries that you're seeing, other journalists and whatnot?
Well, I mean, in terms of Israel being prosecuted for war crimes, you have to say, well, it's been committing war crimes on a daily basis. I mean, since I've been here in Lebanon, every single day we see and we hear of a new war crime, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, people's homes, the targeting of medics, the targeting of journalists. We had a colleague killed earlier this week, Hussein Hamoud, who was a photographer for one of the Lebanese channels. He was in his office, in Nabatea district. So that you can't say that this wasn't a deliberately targeted attack. In Tyre, just yesterday, we went past the offices of Al-Manar, destroyed. The same in Dahir, which is in the southern suburbs of Beirut. They targeted Al-Maidin and Al-Noor, two media organizations, and those buildings were destroyed. These are not military targets. They're not the first time they've come under attack either. So Israel has kind of operated with this total impunity, really. I mean, we saw this in Gaza, hundreds of journalists killed. Even journalists were killed live on air. When they said, well, you know, they try and claim they're not targeting journalists. These journalists were in a camp known to be where the media work from. They were next to a hospital. So, you know, they were targeting a hospital and they were targeting journalists. But there's been no accountability whatsoever. I mean, what they tend to do, and with the journalists in Gaza, we heard them label the journalists as, no, they're not journalists, they're from Hamas, or they're from Palestine Islamic Jihad. They do the same here. It's the journalists are from Hezbollah or something like this. So they always use something to try and justify these heinous acts of terror that they're raining down on the people here in Lebanon. So the war crimes have been going on for a long time. You have to remember, people talk about there was a ceasefire. And so we don't talk about Israel's new war on Lebanon. It's the escalation of what was a war that had already been taking place, because the ceasefire that was signed in November 2024, if you remember, after the 66 days of Israeli war on Lebanon, was never adhered to by the Israelis. They carried out more than 15,000 violations of that ceasefire compared to one that came from Lebanon. This was a retaliatory strike in December 2024. Some people say it was an accident. We don't know for sure who was behind that either. So that's, but I mean, that's just one compared to more than 15,000 violation. So these war crimes have been happening on every single day. We're seeing, and I've seen personally, massacres of children. You know, we've seen the bodies hanging from the trees. We've seen body parts strewn everywhere, children's toys, this kind of thing. So and what they're doing is they're targeting now areas where displaced people are. So they've targeted the Ramada Hotel on the Corniche, which is the iconic seafront in Beirut. You'll probably have seen the Pigeon Rocks, which is kind of a Beirut landmark. So this strike took place there, the Ramada Hotel, the Comfort Hotel, not too far from where I am now. So there was a time when Benjamin Netanyahu, during the war in 2024, they were carrying out similar kind of strikes. They were hunting down displaced people across the country. So they were striking even in the northern part of the country as well. And Netanyahu described the Shia community, because that's the people that are really the ones that are the most targeted by the Israeli aggression. He described them as the enemy within. And I think that kind of says a lot about what we're seeing unfolding on the ground here. But the situation, like we said, is pretty grim. You know, they're talking about an impending humanitarian catastrophe just by the sheer scale of the people that have been displaced. There's some statistics released today. I think 370,000 of those displaced are children. That came from UNICEF earlier this morning, on Friday morning. So. As for accountability, the only country that I know that has called for Israel to be held to account is Russia. And this was in the aftermath of the strikes on us. And we always say, sorry, I've got a bit of a cold. We always say myself, and I can speak for Ali as well, my colleague, that we're incredibly grateful for, the support that we've had from the RT family, from Margarita Simonyan, right the way through our team of wonderful producers and presenters, news editors, journalists, everybody, and all the people that have given those, those wished us well on a personal level. But I have to say, the RT family have been absolutely incredible in the love and the support that they've shown for us, and we'll be forever grateful for that. I'm very proud to work for RT and to be an RT correspondent. And I mean, I'm always very proud, but in that moment, I never really felt prouder of that. But also the Russian state, Maria Zakharova, was very quick out of the blocks to condemn the Israelis for that strike. She was very clear in that it was a targeted strike, that it wasn't accidental. And, the Russian state has called for the Israelis to be held to account. They summoned the Israeli ambassador, they've asked for explanations, and they've raised a complaint. I know that it's gone to the United Nations. Now, compare that. I'm a British citizen, unfortunately, but I am a British citizen, and compare that with the response from my own government, which has been a question was fielded to them about the attack by a British media organisation, some very dear friends of mine at Declassified UK. And the response was, it was as you'd expect, I guess, really. They just simply said, the British government has made our position clear on the Middle East in a statement released to the Commons last Tuesday. So they didn't address the specifics. They just gave a general, this is our position. Now, the British government, you'll probably know, instead of supporting me, they're persecuting me. Last July, on a family visit, I was detained at Heathrow Airport. I was quizzed for the maximum time that they're allowed to quiz me for. I had my DNA taken, swabs, fingerprints, photographed, electronic devices seized. And I'm still now, nearly a year later, I'm still now under investigation under the draconian anti-terror legislation that they have.
Oh my goodness.
Because of my work in Donbass, because of my work in Lebanon, because of reporting from Yemen, because of reporting from Iraq, all of this is journalistic activity. But of course, if it doesn't fit their narrative or the Western narrative, then then it becomes something much different.
And for our viewers, if you could explain a little bit, that the Anti-Terrorism Act is very serious in the UK. It's in America they go after you with a different set of rules, but in the UK, the anti-terrorism, they're going after Richard Medhurst as well and others.
Well, the law is very draconian, and they've gone after Richard Medhurst, they've gone after Craig Murray, they've come after myself. Just yesterday, we heard Dr. Rami Adwan. She's a Palestinian doctor who, again, she was handcuffed and taken away in handcuffs for a social media post that she made. I mean, this is incredible where you handcuff somebody, but for the fifth time. So, and of course, we've seen the arrests of, you know, old women who were protesting the ban on Palestine action that was enforced by the government. So they've broadened this anti-terror legislation out now to such a degree that anything in support of Palestine, anything that opposes Israel essentially is now deemed to be unlawful and terrorist activity. So even like something innocuous, like a photograph I have on my phone, which they still have, was of me in South Lebanon by a huge billboard of Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, the former Hezbollah Secretary General, who was assassinated in an Israeli strike back in September 2024. Something as innocuous as that, because this is very common, by the way, in Lebanon. Most people have pictures of him in their, I guess the supporters of resistance will have pictures of him in their home. You have to remember Hezbollah is a legal political organization in Lebanon, but simply having that photograph could land me 14 years in prison. So this is how serious, this is how serious and restricted things are in Britain at the moment. It's, they're trying to criminalize any kind of support and solidarity. I'm a member of a political party in Britain, the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, a relatively small organization. But even our comrades and our party members, they've had their homes raided, they've had literature seized, again, simply for calling for the right of the Palestinians and the Lebanese to defend themselves. And that's essentially what this comes down to. We hear a lot in the media, Israel has the right to defend itself, but we never hear the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves, the Lebanese have the right to defend themselves, the Iranians have the right to defend themselves, the Russians have the right to defend themselves. Now, all of this is actually enshrined in international law, that right to resist, and that includes even armed resistance. That's enshrined in international law, but of course we know international law only applies to certain parties, and it's created by the powerful, by the imperialist powers, to work for them and not work for the people that are being oppressed by these very, very powerful governments.
Well put, and thank you for being with us today,
Steve. First of all, I want to make a note, because I actually received personally a reply from Israeli ambassador here in Russia after he was summoned, as you know. Yeah, and it was about you, actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, Israel was denying that you were directly targeting. And the statement was saying that they attacked the bridge to preclude the Hezbollah troops from crossing the bridge. And I mean, honestly, everyone, I guess, saw the footage. Mm-hmm. It was only you and Ali, your cameraman, standing there, almost in the middle of nowhere. There were no troops crossing the bridge. As you said, the bridge was already hit. Mm-hmm. But that was the explanation that was given to the public. So, I mean, bullshit, what is?
Yeah.
It is bullshit. I mean, I can respond to that. And if you see the bridge, you couldn't get more than one or two people across the bridge for a starter. I mean, they seem to think that Hezbollah is driving around in trucks with heavy weapons or artillery or something on the back of it. We have to remember, and I think this is an important point, that the Lebanese government had approved very controversially, actually the cabinet, not the government, very controversially a plan to disarm Hezbollah or to bring all weapons under the control of the state. Now, that was approved, I think, in August last year. Phase one was the disarmament of Hezbollah within South Lebanon. So that area south of the Tani River. Now, the army had gone into those areas and Hezbollah had abided by the terms of the ceasefire. There was no Hezbollah presence in that area south of the Tani. This was, don't take my word for it. This was confirmed by UNIFIL, the UN peacekeepers, and the Lebanese army and the Lebanese government. Now, Rudolf Haykal, the army chief, presented in January phase one of the disarmament process is now complete. Mm. Okay, so And we saw the move maybe a few weeks ago where the Prime Minister Nawaf Salam banned Hezbollah's military wing and banned Hezbollah from its military operations. Again, something that's, you know, that's very controversial, but he did it. And you imagine this bridge, again, it's a very small bridge, a really small bridge. And to think that Hezbollah were marching soldiers across it or this kind of thing is an absurdity. The Lebanese army are on that bridge. Right. So the Lebanese army was stationed on that bridge. So if there are any Hezbollah fighters or weapons, they would stop them. So it's simply a lie to say that.
I know. It's a bullshit. But let me ask you a question that seems really important for me, because I've been reading the reports about Israeli aircrafts spreading concentrated herbicides over the southern areas of Lebanon. And I even know that the peacekeepers were warned about that, and they were recommended to hide in a shelter while they were spreading those herbicides. Yeah. And the herbicides, they decrease soil fertility. They are potentially carcinogenic for humans. So what do you know about that? Because if this is true, it actually reminds me of Vietnam or the worst fascist practice, no?
Yes, well, it's absolutely true. We reported on it for RT, actually. We were on the ground. And what happened was the Israelis issued a warning to UN peacekeepers. They said that they were going to spray a substance. They didn't actually say exactly what it was at the time. We do know now that it's glyphosate, which is, as you identified, it's a herbicide, perfectly normal, perfectly legal herbicide.
It's just highly concentrated.
I think it was like somewhere between 30 and 50 times above the safe legal limits.
Wow.
So this was, you know, I mean, if people think Israel was simply there gardening, then, you know.
No way. It was killing. I mean, it's
killing.
But is it a part of Occupy Lebanon? I mean, is it like they're preparing for the annexation of the southern Lebanon? Because that's how things are done, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they laid the groundwork for this over the past 15 months. The spraying of the herbicide was just a part of it. So they sprayed it over a number of the border areas. As I said, RT were one of the organisations, news organisations. I think maybe one of the only ones that made this this report on the ground about what actually happened, the destruction of the vegetation. That's what it does. It doesn't kill weeds. It kills the entire vegetation. It can be have long-term effects, and it's linked to cancer. It's increased levels of cancer. I mean, this is an interesting aside, but levels of cancer in the south of Lebanon have skyrocketed. There's no official studies on it, but the levels of cancer in that area. So this has been subjected to, I mean, what we're seeing today has been happening there for decades, by the way. This isn't a particularly new thing. But we also documented around Al-Bustani and these are other areas in the south of Lebanon, not far from the UN headquarters, actually, in Naoura. But we just documented the use of white phosphorus. And we're talking, I think something like 5,000 acres of agricultural land has been destroyed by the Israelis. Huge swathes of land. In fact, we were in a place called Blida. Now, Blida is one of the border towns, and we went there for the olive harvesting season. And while we were there, we interviewed some local officials, we interviewed some olive farmers, but the Israelis were putting restrictions on who could farm their own land. So they were asking for the names and the vehicle numbers of people that were going to go into the olive groves and farm their own olive groves. We saw the olive trees there are older than the state of Israel itself. You know, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of years old, the olive trees. But whilst we were there, and we did manage to get slightly into the fields and see the olive pickers at work. But the Israelis then came in and started bulldozing the olive groves. And you know, we saw this with our own eyes. This was, you know, this was environmental destruction. But what it is, I mean, the olive is really central to Lebanese culture, Lebanese identity, as well as a source of income for the farm workers in the south of Lebanon. But this is, they're trying to disconnect people from their land, trying to, you know, to uproot the olive trees and break the people's, you know, long-standing connection to their land, people that have lived on this land for generations and generations and generations. Now, there's an interesting development, I guess, for people to understand. There's the Israel has wanted that area, like I said, for you know, since the formation of the State of Israel and even before. And they've tried many times through a number of different, you know, tactics, invasions, occupation. In the 80s, they used the Christian proxy militia, the South Lebanese Army, to maintain control over that area. A brutal, brutal regime that had the notorious Qiyam prison, where they would torture. You know, it was a torture dungeon, horrific. They would go into the villages, round people up, assassinate them. All of this kind of thing. So the latest incarnation is called the Trump Economic Zone. And this is why we call it not just an Israeli project, but it's a kind of an Anglo-American Israeli project. So the Trump Economic Zone kind of sounded innocuous. And you'll remember last year when Tom Barrack, the US envoy, came to Lebanon, and in a press conference he described journalists as animalistic, which got all the headlines, that soundbite. Underneath that, he was out laying down this blueprint. They're calling it a regeneration project. Look, if you let us do this Trump Economic Zone, it will bring jobs, prosperity, roads, infrastructure, this kind of thing, funded with US, Gulf, Qatar and Saudi Arabian money. But it meant the depopulation, which is a polite word of saying ethnic cleansing, the depopulation of entire border settlements. And that was the price that they were supposed to pay for this regeneration project, which wouldn't bring any wealth to the Lebanese people, of course. That wealth would be extracted for the profits of the Americans and the Gulf countries. Mm-hmm. So this was to be policed by American soldiers. Some say 2,000 American troops will be in there policing that that area. And but also with Israeli troops having full access to a number of these villages, some which would be entirely depopulated, others would just come under their control. So this was a project. So we started working on, as RT, the RT crew, we started going to these border villages that were earmarked to be for expulsion. And we met the people on the ground to kind of give it that human the human element to it, because these aren't just villages. It can become quite abstract when you look at it just purely from an outsider's view. So we went there and we met the people that lived in these places, that have lived on the land for generations, many of whom said that, you know, we're not going to give up our land. And they're still saying it now. We would rather die on our land than hand it over to the Israelis or the Americans or whoever. This is the land that belongs to us. So this is this project, and all, it's just a different name for the same thing. They said the same in the 80s. We're going to do roads and this kind of thing. Now they're saying, you know, that we're going to give you, I don't know, that we're going to exploit or develop your land so that it will be better for the people to live there. You'll be nice. It will be safe, and it will be, you know, like a Gaza 2.0. We've seen the plans of of Trump and co. What they want to do in Gaza. They see it as like a real estate plan, a real estate project, and they're seeing the same thing in Lebanon. Now that has been pushed further and further forward. But what this is the Greater Israel project. That's what we're seeing unfolding before our very eyes now. Now, the Greater Israel Project isn't some conspiracy theory. It doesn't sit on the fringes of Israeli society. It's right at the center, at the heart of government. Support from Ben-Gavir, the support from Smotrich, but also from Benjamin Netanyahu himself. So this has transformed now into something that is becoming policy, something that we're seeing unfolded. And this means land from the Nile to the Euphrates. So this affects everybody. This affects Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Turkey. This is the major reshaping of the entire region. The Israelis want it because they think it's their biblical right. The Americans want it because they want to extract the wealth and the resources and exert that pressure and control over the region. So that's kind of what we're seeing. So all these little things that we're talking about, the chemical, the use of the chemical herbicides, the use of white phosphate, the Israelis have built, and people may not know this, but 5 military bases have been built illegally inside Lebanese sovereign territory. Again, RT have been, I think, the only international news crew that has documented the construction of these military bases. We've done so. I mean, they've shot at us and all sorts of things while we've been doing it, but we've done it because, you know, these bases are built illegally inside Lebanese sovereign territory. So Israel is already and has already been occupying South Lebanon. So the plans that we're seeing now, this groundwork, the destruction of the vegetation, the destruction of civilian homes, civilian buildings. Now, you look at South Lebanon, and RT was the first international crew after the ceasefire to do a drive-through of the South. And we were shocked at the time by what we saw, because this was the whole-scale flattening of South Lebanon. You imagine, everyone's seen the images of Gaza, and everyone saw the sheer destruction of Gaza. The same thing is happening here in Lebanon. The same thing happened
Absolutely.
Here in Lebanon.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you were with us today, because you're there on the ground and you're educating a lot of Western, a lot of people in America are not getting the truth about all of this.
But there's genocide happening.
And there's a genocide happening.
Yeah.
And thank you for being very straightforward about it. And also the threads. Yeah, you have a tremendous courage. You and your camera person are heroes. And I know you're still at risk, so please be careful as you continue reporting this, because unfortunately, it looks like this campaign is continuing, this really brutal campaign by the U.S. and Israel.
Well, it's a long-term plan, as Steve has just told us. Yeah. Steve, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for covering all these terrifying things that we've discussed today. And please take care.
Take good care of yourself. Hydrate.
I will do. Okay. And I'm going to wear a helmet.
And wear your helmet.
And wear a helmet.
Yeah, wear your helmet.
That's important.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
Take care.
So that's all we have time for today, but we'll keep on trying to keep you in the loop of what's going on in the world. Please keep on sharing your guest suggestions, your questions that you would like us
And thank you. And thank you so much for your participation. We've noticed we've gotten a lot more followers. We're going to keep bringing you the truth. Olga got a lot of hits as far as her interest in her stories about, living in Russia. And, we have really engaging guests. So please follow us on Telegram, follow us on X and other social media. And peace out.
Take care. Bye.